is A, civilians are being evacuated into areas that have been bombed, that have no facilities, and are continuously bombing. They are still being bombed as Israel has ordered civilians into them. And you see in some cases Israeli military maneuver, Israeli invasion into the area it itself designated as safe zones. So in a sense, you see those categories operating in relation to each other as part of an overall strategy, rather than you're seeing humanitarian principle pushing against military violence and moderating it. You see, it has become one of the tools in the Israeli campaign toolbox to generate that level of destruction in Gaza. So, you know, you're speaking about 70% of the areas being displaced.
I only have 10 seconds.
The proportion of people displaced is much higher, and the proportion of civilian infrastructure destroyed is almost complete. So look at those things together and understand the militarization of humanitarian principles.
A.O. Weitzman, we clearly have so much to talk about. We'd like you to ask to stay, and we'll post part two online at democracynow.org. A.O. Weitzman is a British-Israeli architect, founder and director of Forensic Architecture. We'll link to the new report, Humanitarian Violence, Israel's Abuse of Preventive Measures in the 23-24 Genocidal Military Campaign in Occupied Gaza Strip.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
It's in the streets, it's in the streets. It's in the streets, it's in the streets.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland man scores a win from the U.S. Supreme Court in his fight over being on the no-fly list. Pacific Northwest lawmakers are at the heart of the battle over the nation's budget, with a shutdown deadline looming tomorrow. And a Transgender Day of Visibility is coming soon to our community after Multnomah County Commissioners took action today. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 21st, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. An infamous court case linked to a terrorism prosecution in Portland has a new twist. KBOO's Lisa Loving has the story.
The U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday ruled Yonas Fikre can still sue the U.S. federal government on the grounds that its no-fly list is unconstitutional. The ruling held that an Oregon district judge's dismissal of Fikre's case after the federal government removed him from the list did not invalidate his claims. Back in 2010, Fikre was an Eritrean-American Portland resident who traveled to Sudan to start up an electronics import business. He was questioned on alleged terrorist activities after he arrived by agents with the Joint Terrorism Task Force at the FBI office in Portland, who had traveled to Sudan and lured him to the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum. Fikra said the agents questioned him about activities at his mosque in Portland, Masjid As-Sabir. It was the same mosque where Somali teenager Mohammed Osman Mohamud occasionally attended. Mohamud was arrested for allegedly plotting to blow up the Portland Christmas tree lighting ceremony a few months later and eventually convicted. He's now serving a 30-year sentence in prison. Mohamud's attorneys argued unsuccessfully that the case involved FBI entrapment. Fikra alleges that the U.S. agents in Khartoum were trying to recruit him as a spy at the Portland mosque and threatened to put him on the no-fly list for not answering questions. When Fikra eventually moved to the United Arab Emirates to start his business, he was arrested by local officials there, interrogated about his activities in Portland, and beaten for more than 3 months. Eventually, the UAE released Fikra without charge. He filed his lawsuit in 2016 against the U.S. federal government for using the no-fly list to recruit unwilling spies for the FBI. Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Fikra's lawsuit, thrown out in 2018 when officials said they removed him from the list, could still proceed. Quote, put simply, the government's sparse declaration falls short of demonstrating that it cannot reasonably be expected to do again in the future what it is alleged to have done in the past, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote. For KABU News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Intense debates are underway in the nation's capital as lawmakers are trying to win votes for their priorities in the government's budget. If it's not renewed by Friday, there could be a shutdown. As the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Oregon senior U.S. Senator Ron Wyden talked about the budget for the Treasury Department and looked at the overall state of the economy.
Right now, the United States has the strongest major economy in the world. Don't have to take my word for it. Trump advisor Stephen Moore agreed with that statement in a recent interview. Wages rising significantly faster than inflation, which has come down. The labor market has never been better for workers. There's been real progress on income inequality. This is a period of booming entrepreneurship in America as new business applications are up. Go back 4 years when COVID cases were filling up the hospitals and Americans were stuck at home wondering if and when they'd be able to stock up on toilet paper. Forecasts for the economy were dire. The economy under President Biden has smashed those negative forecasts to bits. Nearly every other country in the world with a developed economy would love to trade places with the United States in 2024. Now, if you listen to Donald Trump, you would believe that the United States is on a fast track to the dark ages. What does he want to do when it comes to big economic policy? For one, Trump allies are developing a new tax agenda, cooking up big plans for tax hikes on working Americans and middle-class families. There'll be more tax breaks for multinational corporations and big handouts to those up at the very top, the billionaires. Donald Trump wants to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act. We spent a lot of time working on that in this committee room. He wants to, as part of that repeal, include the funding for the IRS that has vastly improved customer service and cracked down on wealthy tax cheats. Donald Trump's proposals would run bigger deficits and pile up more debt. That would make it impossible to shore up bedrock American programs like Medicare and Social Security. Recently, Donald Trump told an interviewer in the first interview on economics in quite some time that Donald Trump believes there's lots of room for cuts to these vital programs, particularly Social Security. His campaign had to walk it back because they know his real plans on these issues are a loser for the public. In my view, Americans want a strong economy, they want a fair shake for people who don't have big fortunes and political power, and they want policies that drive down the cost of living in our country. That is not what Donald Trump has on offer, but that's exactly what we're zeroing in on. For example, last year I introduced the billionaire's income tax. There are now 18 Senate co-sponsors. President Biden's budget includes his own proposal which has focused on ending the scheme that allows billionaires to pay what they want, when they want to, and sometimes nothing at all for years on end. And it all involves, as the Secretary knows, three words. If a billionaire doesn't want to pay taxes for a long time, they can just buy, borrow, and die. Do those three things, and you don't pay much, if any, taxes. And here's how it works. A billionaire acquires an asset that just gains in value. Maybe they just buy 5-6 houses. Can't live them but one at a time, but they buy all these houses, just sit on them, borrow against them, and then when they die, all the taxes are reconfigured. And meanwhile, people who earn a wage are paying taxes out of each and every paycheck. That's a basic unfairness. And I share the president's view that we're capitalists. We want people to be successful, make plenty of money, but we also believe in fairness. And that's what's on the line now. And the billionaire tax ought to be the centerpiece of the effort to save Social Security for future generations and uphold the Medicare guarantee. We also want to keep upgrading taxpayer service, already vastly improved thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act funding, while giving every American the opportunity to file tax returns directly with the IRS. By the way, this whole approach has been bipartisan in this committee for many years. I'm looking at our friend from Tennessee, Dan Coats, at one time was on this committee and wrote a bipartisan bill with me to do just that. Direct file opened widely in a handful of states last week. In just a matter of days, tens of thousands of Americans have filed or started their returns using this new system, and they are saving big on fees when they do. That's progress that has to continue. Donald Trump's allies want to stop it. They'll side with the tax prep companies against typical taxpayers, and it's safe to say that Donald Trump himself is no champion of tax enforcement against the billionaires and the people at the top. Before I wrap up, I want to mention one other topic that members of this committee know a fair amount about. It has now been 7 full weeks since 357 members of the House voted to pass legislation that was developed by Republican Chair Jason Smith and myself over a period of many months. The legislation restores important incentives, particularly for small business, research and development incentives, and expands the child tax credit. I've listened to many of my Republican Senate colleagues, and I've made it clear that I will work with anybody who wants to find a way to get this done quickly. You've heard all this talk, Madam Secretary, about maybe you put it off till 2025. There's some big businesses that might be able to survive that. But these innovative, small companies that look at that R&D break as a lifeline, they're not going to make it until 2025. The number one concern I've heard from Republicans is the child tax credit look-back policy. I heard that from a number of colleagues. They think that as structured by Chairman Smith and I, that this would somehow discourage work. I don't happen to agree with that. The Joint Committee on Taxation doesn't happen to agree with it. But in order to make for a bipartisan bill, it's been a long time since we've had a bipartisan tax bill around here. Some of my colleagues haven't even seen one. I have offered to take the look-back provision out of what Chairman Smith and I developed if it helps us get this bipartisan bill over the finish line. Working with community leaders, we have found a way to do this and still lift the same number of kids out of poverty. I want colleagues of both parties on the committee to know that the offer to remove the look-back policy that was in the Smith-Wyden legislation is still on the table as of this morning, if we can find common ground and move ahead. And as I mentioned, this idea of waiting till 2025, particularly for these innovation-oriented small businesses, Senator Hassan has led the effort to point this out over several years, I think would cause us to do significant damage to the economy and certainly to the innovation ethic that colleagues on both sides of this dais have supported. I believe there are more than 60 members of the Senate who want to act on this in a bipartisan way. I sure believe that it's important to do bipartisan tax work now that actually helps people. And if anything, it sets the table for 2025.
That was Oregon's U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Another voice from the Northwest having a big part in these intense budget talks is Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray.
It's been a very long road, but we have a bipartisan, bicameral funding agreement, and we're finally nearly ready to close the book on FY24. These aren't the bills that Democrats would have written on our own. They are the result of very tough negotiations. We've had to stick to some very difficult top lines and fight off literally hundreds of Republican poison pills, not to mention some really hard, almost unthinkable cuts proposed by House Republicans. But now we have a good bipartisan bill that protects absolutely essential investments in American people. These bills reflect input and priorities from nearly, we're talking about six bills that help determine how we invest in America's future, funding everything from childcare, pre-K programs, K-12 public schools, to Pell Grants and workforce training programs. They determine how much we invest in public health infrastructure, efforts to treat addiction, stop the flow of fentanyl, how much we are investing in cutting-edge research that literally saves lives, how much we're going to invest in our service members and in defense and diplomatic programs that are essential to America's security and global leadership. And that's just scratching the surface. With so much on the line, there's absolutely no reason for a pointless and costly shutdown. With bipartisan cooperation, we can get this done before our deadline. No one should want a shutdown. No one should cause a shutdown. Let's pull together and get this done. Democrats understand that, and we've been ready every time to move quickly and responsibly to fund the government. Excuse the former preschool teacher in me, but here's the lesson I hope everyone learns when we pass these last six bills. When we listen to each other and to the American people, instead of the loudest voices on the far right, we can work together and we can actually pass meaningful bills that help people.
And that was Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast from the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, we have American Indian Airways. Tonight's weather, 48 degrees at the lowest with rain. Tomorrow will also be raining with a high of 59. Today in history, on this date, African-American singer Solomon Burke was born. He incorporated the gospel style of the African-American churches with rhythm and blues, or R&B, and his success in the early 1960s helped to bring in the soul music era. Our quote of the day is from Mel Blanc, the voice of Bugs Bunny and other Looney Tunes characters. He said, "If I saw a person smile, that to me was payment in itself." A special day to remember and honor the people in our transgender community. That's what the Multnomah County Commission decided to vote on. Here's part of what Commission Chair Jessica Vega-Peterson and Commissioners Jesse Beeson and Sue Myron said about that today.
Multnomah County Board of Commissioners proclaims March 31st, 2024 as Transgender Day of Visibility in Multnomah County, Oregon. And with this proclamation affirms the commitment to support our gender expansive community.
Thank you so much. We'll start with Commissioner Beeson.
I was about two credits shy from being a history minor, so I always like to bring history into the room when I can and recognize a former Oregonian, Dr. Alan Hart, who was born female presenting in 1890. Alan made his way to Oregon and graduated from my alma mater, Lewis and Clark College, in 1912. 5 years later, became the highest recognized, at that time, woman graduate of OHSU in 1917. Later that year, Alan convinced a doctor using eugenics arguments to get a hysterectomy, which I think only proves that trans folks have had to fight for the medical care that they deserve using all the tools in the toolbox. Then Alan began to live as a man and had the most amazing career as a doctor and radiologist and wrote 4 novels. I think that the visibility of trans folks is so incredibly important because it shows that the political project to erase trans people in this country and across the globe is relatively recent, because we have cultures that have for thousands of years recognized the important role that trans folks play in our culture, and the fact that they are welcome, that they are natural, and that they bring all their gifts to bear on society. I just want to appreciate all the work that you all do on behalf of the county, all the work that you do to make trans lives more visible and matter in this community, and recognize that there is a cost and a burden to that, and appreciate that continued commitment to do what's necessary to move us forward.
Thank you so much. Commissioner Myron.
We celebrate the lives of transgender people, calling out their basic human right to live authentically while still acknowledging that due to discrimination, the threat of real harm, not every trans person can or wants to be visible at this time. We have the opportunity to understand just a little bit more, to be able to reflect, to be inspired, to learn, to grow. Every action that we take, the proclamations that we do, when sometimes we think, why, what does a proclamation do? Why it is so important to be visible in a world that is so full of isolation, recognizing the intersectionality of all of our lives and what we do, and that the global is indeed the local, and vice versa. The real harm and dangers that come with visibility. In seeing the light and the beauty and so much of the spirit and energy and contributions of so many people here today and people in the trans community, we also have to acknowledge the harm, that need to constantly be combating discrimination, prejudice, marginalizations, violence, and murder against our transgender community, and the self-harm and suicide brought about by all of these actions by those who hate and bully and harm. From those challenges that are experienced here by people in our workforce, by people sitting in our audience today, by people listening in, by the millions who aren't anywhere near us, we have to be fighting for secure housing, for access to health care, including gender affirming care, safety in our education systems, and breaking through to end the heartbreaking rates of violence and suicide, especially experienced by transgender youth. We have to be doing all of this work. And when I think of the harm, I can't help but take a moment to pause and reflect on Next Benedict, that how alone and harmed they felt. But seeing here and hoping that others recognize that they are not alone, their lives matter and are so important, and we need to do everything to support them. This is my last year on the board, so today's proclamation does take on special meaning for me, and I have to acknowledge I might freak out one of my kids that's here today. I have 2 non-binary kids. One is in the audience with their friend. I will try not to look specifically at them. One really wanted to be here, but is at school, is in college learning, studying to be a teacher. Whenever I talk to them about teaching, they talk about what they are going to do to expand understanding and intentionally focus on queer and gender inclusivity in the classrooms to make kids feel safe. I'm just so grateful to my kids for everything that they have taught me, for how they show up in the world. And as a parent, the most I've hoped for and continue to hope for is that they can live authentically and be safe. As a county commissioner, my job is to strive for a world where everyone's kids, people, can live authentically and be safe. That is the sacred role, really, that we have here on this commission, and I'm just grateful. Thank you.
I want to thank all of today's presenters for being here to help us honor Trans Day of Visibility. Our transgender and gender nonconforming people and their lives and experiences. I also want to appreciate Commissioner Myron and your staff for being such incredible leaders and allies in the transgender and gender nonconforming awareness and visibility. This time that we spend in the board recognizing this will is going to continue, but I appreciate your leadership. As Commissioner Beeson said, transgender and gender nonconforming people have been here since the beginning of time, since there were people, and having a chance to make space today in our community, in our culture, in our society, to elevate the visibility, to elevate the contributions that are taking place today, and work as much as we can to make spaces where people feel safe, can bring their authentic selves into our community so that we all have the benefit of their gifts, their presence, their wholeness, their entire beings. That's the work that we do. It's one of our core values at Multnomah County of inclusiveness, of creating that space. We saw that represented last week in some of the workforce equity strategic plan renewal process and some of the components of that, so that we are trying to build systems and build those places that outlast any one person, but create that space here in Multnomah County. We know across the United States, we see politicians using trans and gender nonconforming communities as political props in ways that not only damages the fabric of our society, but decreases the safety and support that those communities deserve. And when a politician or community passes policies that devalue and dehumanize transgender people, limit or remove their basic rights, or otherwise discriminate against them, it causes harm to mental health, to a sense of belonging, too often through acts of physical violence that are the result, and it damages all of us as a community. That harm we know impacts young people who are just beginning to explore their identities, and they should be assured by all of us that they'll have access to safe spaces to explore and find support and community. I believe that our community can and should provide safe spaces for gender and identity exploration, and value the ways that Multnomah County has and will continue to make that possible, because that's what Trans Day of Visibility is all about. So I'm incredibly grateful for the work, contributions, and perseverance of our trans and gender nonconforming community members and allies, and I am dedicated to working in partnership alongside you to ensure that Multnomah County can be a safe place, can remain a safe place and community where every one of us can thrive in our truest selves. The proclamation is adopted.
And you just heard members of the Multnomah County Commission as they voted to make March 31st Multnomah County's Transgender Day of Visibility. Some lawmakers in the Northwest are looking at adding new restrictions to the process for getting citizen initiatives on the ballot. Eric Tegedov looks at how this could make it tougher to get enough signatures to qualify, especially during Idaho's snowy months.
With a little more than a week left in the session, House Bill 652 is being considered in the Senate. It would do a number of things to change qualifications for ballot measures brought by citizens. That includes requiring monthly signature verification from local county clerks and a two-month review period when people who sign the ballot could remove their signatures. Sam Sandmeyer with Bay Vote notes it also moves the deadline to gather signatures from April 30th to March 31st.
We have winter months going through late spring sometimes. This would be extremely burdensome because bad weather through the winter months can make door knocking to collect signatures difficult, especially for elderly volunteers.
Lawmakers in support of the bill say it would add transparency to the process. Sandmeyer says the Idaho Constitution guarantees the right to bring initiatives to voters.
There is one part of the Constitution that provides for direct democracy action, and that is the Citizen Ballot Initiative. It states that citizens can propose and pass laws.
Sandmeyer says there have been other attempts by lawmakers to restrict the ballot initiative process, but the Idaho Supreme Court struck down at least one of these laws. She says a majority of people have testified against the current bill as well.
It's extremely frustrating to have these bills brought forward, passed, signed into law when citizens are overwhelmingly opposed.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Political ads often talk about a candidate's ability to fight for the working class. But as Mike Moen reports, new research shows the working class is woefully underrepresented in state legislatures all across the country.
The backgrounds of people serving in state legislatures largely leave out a key demographic, the working class. That's according to a new national study. Researchers at Duke University and Loyola University Chicago say their study finds the share of legislators across the country who have mainly held working-class jobs as adults was below 2% in 2023. In contrast, 50% of the U.S. labor force is made up of manual labor workers, the service industry, and clerical or union jobs. Report co-author Eric Hansen says the data represents a clear disconnect.
There's this real sense that government and elected officials are really out of touch with the population. And one of the reasons for that is because our elected officials don't really come from the same set of backgrounds that most Americans come from.
He says boosting the ranks could restore trust and usher in more economic policies that help those with lower incomes. And it's not just a partisan issue, with the study noting the small percentage of existing legislators who are working class is almost equal among Democrats and Republicans. Hansen says the cost of campaigning is often a barrier to working class folks who might consider running.
It's just really hard to support yourself and campaign when you are holding a working class job.
And researchers say because of the way the campaign finance system is structured, it's hard to foster solutions. But they say recruiters can do their part by trying to make more connections with people who work lower wage jobs, engage whether they can become more involved, and potentially run for a seat. This is Mike Moen.
Republicans proceed with what they call an impeachment investigation of President Biden, frustrating Democrats. House Speaker Mike Johnson faces pressure from the GOP as a possible government shutdown looms, and the Alabama governor signs a bill banning ballot harvesting. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
Rudy Giuliani, on behalf of then-President Donald Trump, tasked me with a mission to travel the globe, finding dirt on the Bidens so that an array of networks could spread misinformation about them, thus securing the 2020 election for Donald J. Trump.
Lev Parnas, a convicted former aide to Rudy Giuliani, testifying to Congress to what he describes as a coordinated effort to falsely accuse the Bidens of corruption in Ukraine. Republicans are moving forward with an inquiry into impeaching President Joe Biden, but New York progressive Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez challenged them to name his specific crimes.
Impeachment 101. The majority party or whomever is raising impeachment must accuse the president of a high crime, a specific high crime or misdemeanor.
Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says he's about to release the text of spending bills that would avoid a Friday government shutdown. But with what he calls a wide chasm of partisan policy differences and only a 3-vote margin, Johnson may need Democratic votes to get it passed.
I think the final product is something that we were able to achieve a lot of key provisions in and wins and a move.